Today on Promotion Man, we discuss the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Class of 2020. Who is Chuck E. and is he actually in love with Ricky Lee Jones? Fred Myers talks about the amount of time it takes to set up a single release. And we wrap up with an in-depth conversation about the Sultans of Swing, Dire Straits.
We haven't done cleanup in a while, and chances are we probably should. I should probably go back and find all the messes we made.
Cleanup on aisle two.
But a couple of weeks ago when we did Stu Cohen's interview, he had brought up about Cashbox versus Billboard.
Right.
And I had said, well, we're going to check that out. And so Cashbox started in 1942, and Billboard started in 1898.
Crazy.
So we get that out of the way.
All right. Well, that's good.
Then we had talked about rumors as far as, you know, how high a sales is that compared to Eagles and Michael Jackson. So the way it plays out is the rumors by Fleetwood Mac is the number three best-selling album of all time.
Wow.
The Eagles' Greatest Hits is number one, and it surpassed Michael Jackson's Thriller, which is now at number two.
So rumors comes in at number three, which is not too shabby.
No, because you're in the 30-plus million range.
Yeah.
And then Cream, Stewart had brought up because of his little argument with Prince about releasing that, and he had to guarantee it was going to be number one. And it actually ended up being number one for 2 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100 in November of 1991.
Yeah. I remember I was living in L.A., and I listened to that album every day driving on my commute. Every day.
Did you really?
I did. Every day. Still on the CD, it's a little beat up, but I still have it.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much our cleanup. Well, if we're not following that episode, I guess it doesn't even matter.
Well.
All right. So do we want to talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees?
Yes, we do. And I think this is highly important because one of our artists who I thought was a great interview with Wayne Kramer from the MC5 is one of the nominees. So I'm kind of hoping that as more conversation is about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you and I can refer people back, the new listeners I'm talking about, and say, hey, if you want to find out more about the MC5, go back and get this great in-depth interview with Wayne because he did it so eloquently.
He did. I mean, the thing about MC5 is now they're being recognized by their peers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is the Super Bowl of rock and roll. And the MC5, even though they never had huge success from album sales, this signifies that they had a huge effect on the culture and the time of rock and roll, and that they were, you know, one of the most inspiring rock and roll bands at the time. And this kind of verifies all that.
Yeah, for sure. I tell you, it's quite a diverse list this year. I mean, there's about 16 or so. We got Pat Benatar.
Which is great.
Yeah, I was huge fan. I think she deserves to be in there. I mean, she was a very vocal female performer back during her era in a genre that is definitely just dominated by men. And Pat always had her place on the charts, for sure. And then there's Dave Matthews Band. And then Depeche Mode, who's been thrown out there before but didn't make it. But here's one, Fred. I want you to talk about the next one. That I'm surprised they haven't been nominated before, and that's the Doobie Brothers.
It's shocking, really, that it's taken this long, because when you listen to our past podcast, we talk about Minute by Minute, you know, winning the Grammy for Album of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And on my way here and sitting in the lobby waiting for us to record this, you know, Facebook is kind of blowing up because of the nominees and some of these bands. And some of my old Warner Brother alumni are all saying it's about time that the Doobie Brothers have finally been nominated, as well as Thin Lizzy, who was a Warner Brother act, Kraftwerk, Todd Rundgren, who was on Bearsville, but we worked all of Todd Rundgren's music.
Right.
Now, it is Rufus featuring Chaka Khan,
right.
And Warner Brothers had her as a solo artist, Chaka Khan.
You know, and Soundgarden, I think, is going to be probably a first-year nominee that'll go in there, just simply because, you know, Chris Cornell's passed away. I mean, they have a great legacy, and most of those bands that were huge grunge acts have all, you know, like Nirvana's gone in, and so I think Soundgarden is definitely a shoe-in. I think Whitney Houston is probably a shoe-in as
yeah,
well.
But powerful.
I think it'll be very cool. I hope Judas Priest makes it, because I would just love to see the sets, you know, if they had Whitney people coming out doing her song, and then we follow that up with Judas Priest. That's going to be quite the night for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but and there's one that I'm a little, I don't understand. It's Notorious B.I.G.
Clean up on aisle two.
And well, I'm not taking away anything from him and their legacy, but I think it's way too soon.
I think it's, but isn't Tupac in there? I think Tupac's in there.
Might be.
I think that you got the Notorious B.I.G. that's in there with representing the East Side, and I think I that's probably where that nomination is coming from. Motorhead, of course, we lost Lemmy, you know, a couple years ago, and so I don't know if that one's quite going to hit it the first time. Maybe. I mean, you know, like I said, sometimes they say death is a great career move. But, you know, going back to Kraftwerk, we mentioned that band, one of our earlier podcasts of, you know, how much influence they had.
Yeah.
And so I think they've been put out there before, never quite made it, and they still might not make it this year. But I think you're going to see bands like Kraftwerk, the MC5, some that weren't like in the big commercial mainstream, but were so influential, they got to have their spot in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I agree, which brings us to T-Rex.
Right.
Bang a Gong.
Get it on.
I mean, what a song that, you know, I think was a big fabric of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And I'm really thrilled that that's up too.
I mean, that was kind of the earliest glam rock, I would say, that I recall, at least, that was, you know, kind of mainstream with a huge hit, right?
Yep, very much. And because it was T-Rex, it was Roxy Music, it was David Bowie, it was Gary Glitter.
Yeah.
It was Mott the Hoople. It was that kind of era right there that we're bringing this glam rock, if you will.
And I'm glad you brought up Mott the Hoople, because there was a huge story from Joe Elliott of Def Leppard, who was just put into the 2019 class, who is doing a hard push to get Mott the Hoople to get nominated, because they haven't been nominated. And he was like, they deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it's kind of cool how some of the ones, the younger bands who are so influenced by some of these bands, as I said, that weren't in the mainstream, who are now going like, I want to get my rock and roll heroes in there as well.
Yeah. And with that being said, you know, we're recording this in October of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier in the year, I had noticed that Mott the Hoople were actually on a very limited tour.
Yeah.
Like they were playing Chicago and some very limited dates, and the feedback and the reviews were like through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Like people were just absolutely astounded at how great Ian Hunter had sounded and the way the band delivered.
They were going to tour this year, and we had a date coming in Austin where we record the podcast, but that show got canceled. I don't know if the whole tour has been canceled or not, but something fell apart, and they're not coming here at least. So I don't know what happened and for the reason for the cancellation.
As we were following my tour schedule, I really started looking at that and going, you know what, as much as we've had a lot of fun and we've had some great episodes about it, there's some releases that are coming out that I'm starting to miss, and they're big releases. And this one in particular was, remember I talked about the box? So I'd get this weekly box,
yeah,
and inside it would be all these goodies. Well, in this particular week, I open it up, and there's two pre-releases, and I swear I'll never forget it, because again, they came with no writing, no nothing. It's just two black, you know, black vinyl, white label, white jacket,
right,
and a typewritten sheet of paper. And one was a band called Dire Straits.
Yeah.
And the other was Ricky Lee Jones.
So debut album we're talking about for Dire Straits, you never heard anything much about them except what you just got in the box that day.
Yeah.
Cool.
And same with Ricky Lee Jones. Didn't really have anything there either. And today I have two, platinum records for both of those, and it was really pretty cool.
I mean, Chucky's In Love is just going through my brain right now. I mean, what a great song that was. It was just, and she performed it, I think, on SNL and all these different shows. But man, she was so charismatic, just cool girl.
She, you know, here's the thing. She was almost like a modern version of a Joni Mitchell in her own way.
Yeah.
She was very cool. Kind of had her own kind of groove and kind of walking a tightrope of being somewhat beatnik,
yeah,
and being like hippie. And we actually, even as promotional items, put out these velvet berets.
Oh, nice.
You know, that said Ricky Lee Jones, and they were maroon. And I think I got like about 50 of them.
And now we know where Prince got the idea for Raspberry Beret. Huh?
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Ricky Lee Jones. Yeah. I mean, the album was released in the spring of 1979 to mostly favorable reviews, propelled by the substantial jazz pop hit single Chuckie's in Love.
Yeah.
The single became, it went all the way to number 4 in the U.S. during the summer. And the album went on to become a million seller and went up as high as number 3 on the U.S. charts.
Nice.
And that's one of these albums where all my other record buddies would grab me and say, dude, I love this Ricky Lee Jones record.
Right.
I mean, there were deep, really deep songs like Last Chance Texaco, Coolsville.
Who was Chuckie? Do you know?
Well, Chuckie was her friend. His name was Chuck E. Weiss.
Okay.
And there, you know, and the song was based on a rumored romance that they had.
Right.
She had performed that track on Saturday Night Live in April of 1979.
That's what I was thinking of. And I remember watching that. And I was just like, man, she's just got this cool charisma about her and her own fashion and just the way she grooved. Like you said, she was in her own little world.
And she was very cool.
Yeah.
Had this very cool persona. And Youngblood was another track that cracked the top 40. But here's the craziest part about that. This box that I talked about literally came out in October of 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1978, in the box of goodies is the Dire Straits debut album and then Ricky Lee Jones. Well, this gets to show you how far in advance we would get a record because Dire Straits came out right away.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about it in a second. But my point is both of those advances came to me in October. And we released Ricky Lee Jones in April of 79.
Wow.
So I had that advance for, I guess, 5 or 6 months ahead of the before we released it.
And I've heard so many bands just talk about the frustration after they finish this thing, you know, like they're ready to get out there, they're ready to tour on it, and they go like, the label's just sitting on it, it's on the shelf, we have no idea when it's coming out to work in their marketing strategy, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they go like, then we're on the road, and it's a year later after we wrote the album, and then it's kind of like, we're already ready to do the next album because we're already tired of these songs.
Thank you, because this gives me so much to talk about. So when we look at these records and we look at them as a complete project, not only are we looking at what should be the first single and what should be the second single, but we also look at what's out there right now. What's our competition right now? If the competition is fierce, because we had talked in past podcasts about how record companies gear up for fourth quarter.
Right.
Well, radio only has so many slots they're going to give for new music. They're just not going to add more slots.
Yeah.
So certain bands are going to be dropped prematurely because they're not showing the kind of growth, but there's these superstar acts that automatically get on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at a debut album by bands that have never had a track record, like Ricky Lee Jones or Dire Straits, the record company does this huge overview and goes, okay, let's look at everything because we have to give our artists the best chance at success, which could be exactly why we didn't release Ricky Lee Jones in fourth quarter.
Right.
We probably looked at what was coming out. We have intel about other record companies and what they're going to be putting out.
And I got to tell you, Chuckie's in Love is more of a springtime, summer, you know, roll your window down kind of song. You know, you're just cruising. To me, it doesn't sound like a song I want to hear in November or December. I mean, it seems to me just like a warm weather song. So I think the climate and the seasons have a lot to do with releasing music as well. Am I right on that?
No, I think you are absolutely right. And I loved when we talked about tempo. We talked about a lot of things on the podcast, and one was tempo because you want certain fast songs, then you want a nice down, mid tempo and ballad. But I think you're absolutely right. So I think in this particular case, even though I was a local promotion man and not really privy to the upper executive decision making, when you look back at some of this stuff, there's clearly a rhyme and reason why we tell the bands, you know, just got to be patient. So let's move right into Dire Straits.
Yes, let's do, because Sultans of Swing, I would pretty much feel safe saying this. That song has never left the radio since the first day it got played there. I mean, because it's still being played just as much today in a regular rotation on classic rock radio as it probably was as a current.
I hear it on a regular basis.
It's never left. I mean, it's kind of cool.
And that's the such an amazing thing to talk about is this was, you know, 1978,
yeah,
turning the corner onto 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember distinctly smoking a joint and putting the album on, and I had a really wonderful turntable, and I had some great speakers. And I remember just tracking that album. And as a promotion man, I used to I still do to this day, I listen to things over and over and over.
Right.
I'm looking for the hooks. I'm looking for the grooves. I'm looking for the bridge. I'm looking for the breaks. I want to know the song so well that I want to be able to really take a hard look at which one is going to get my vote for the first single, which is going to get my vote for the second single. And at Warner's, we had a couple really great strategies. Sometimes we would identify what we all felt as a group on the promotion staff, what the number one big single is going to be.
Right.
And then we'd come out with the second single.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason we do that is we'd bring out the second single first,
mm-hmm,
and get a base built. And then once that base is built, then we'd clobber them over the head with what we thought was the runaway hit single.
Right.
And that's when the album would really start to sell in big quantities, which is what we were after.
Unfortunately, it didn't work out that well for the MC5, as that record label did not have the same strategy, obviously.
And, you know, it's funny because I was just in New York. I was just in New York this past weekend, and I got this amazing opportunity to go to the Warner Music Group, which is Warner Brothers, Elektra, and Atlantic. And being in the building right in New York,
yeah,
being in when I walked into the reception area, they had this amazing Atlantic logo that was lit up, and it was part of the reception desk.
Wow.
And then they had this photo that was just a shot of a crowd, and it was just nothing but kids with their hands up. And it was actually black and white and very cool, and it must have been about 20 feet by 15 feet. It was just this massive photograph on a wall.
That's awesome.
And then they took the downstairs stairway, where under the stairway is equipment set up, mm-hmm, for any band that wants to showcase anything or do anything live. They can come and do it for the employees. But next to the stairwell was a picture of Ahmet Edegen, who is the chairman of Atlantic Records. And they took song lyrics from Atlantic artist songs and made his face out of the lyrics.
That is cool.
I have pictures of it, and I'll put it up on on our website. But
what a great tribute to the man by just having all the lyrics of the songs that he had just made these people superstars, and then they made this art of his face with the lyrics.
It was amazing. I had a chance to be with a very dear friend of mine, Mike Easterlin, and he's now running Elektra Records with a partner. And it's really cool that they brought Elektra Records back as a stand-up label.
Yeah.
So he walked me around. He showed me a recording studio that had a full system for a wonder. They had a D&W drum set that was all set, yeah, and ready to go, keyboards.
Right.
They had another guitar room. And then they had this amazing recording studio board. And I met the girl who was running it. And truthfully told, he says, any of our artists can come here at any time,
wow,
to put finishes on things or whatever they want to do. They want to lay down a demo track that they've just want to get done. This recording studio is for our artists whenever they want to come in.
Sounds kind of like what Capitol did so many years ago for Frank Sinatra and some of the big bands and stuff like that. They had it right there in the tower.
Yeah, and when Stu Cohen gave us his interview, he had talked about how Lowell George and Ry Cooder and all these different bands would be in the Warner Brothers studios just hanging out and playing guitars and whatnot. So I have to tell you, Lloyd, being in that environment was incredible because, you know, you think about the history of that building.
Yeah.
And then you think about the history that they're even making today because they have these really huge 10 foot by 10 foot squares of every single artist they have currently lining the hallways of part of the different areas where the executives are.
What is the vibe like in a Warner Brothers promotion office today compared to 40 years ago? I mean, is the vibe still pretty much the same? Is everyone kind of obviously going for the same goal to get their artists out there? But is how would you say, what are the similarities and what are the complete differences 40 years later?
Okay, let's go with the similarities first.
Okay.
The similarities was just the energy.
Yeah.
The energy in that space was very creative.
Mm-hmm.
And it oozed creative, you know, you could feel it, you could see it all around you, it was very vibrant. The differences were all of Mike's plaques, you know, all his gold records are just different plaques than they were the shiny gold or platinum album.
Right.
And the kids that are now in the music business are the ones posting on social media pages.
Right.
So they're more about their computers and doing that.
Yeah.
Where back in the day, you'd have DJ copies everywhere. You had albums everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You had more of the tchotchkes or promotional items everywhere. And that's toned down quite a bit.
So it's a little more cleaner.
Yeah. Yeah, it is cleaner. And Mike.
No clutter.
Yeah. And I need to get back to Mike Easterlin on this because he goes, I want to play you something. And of course, he plays it off of his laptop.
Right.
And his speaker system is amazing.
I'm
and he's
sure.
got the subwoofer. And it's just like phenomenal stereo system. And he plays me about three tracks of somebody who they haven't released yet.
Okay.
And I got to tell you, rock and roll is not dead.
Good,
They've got some rock and roll coming out that is incredible.
I am happy to hear that.
And it was fun for me to be in that position of being able to listen to something brand new that no one's heard. And it to be as spectacular sounding. It was very full.
Yeah.
I even told him, I said, man, it's very full, it's really rich, it's really deep. It was a female singer who had a really distinctive voice.
Wow.
So it was really great.
Well, you've struck my curiosity. You have to tell me after we end the
podcast.
Yeah,
I actually have to text him and say, who was that again?
We'll get a cease and desist from Mike on this podcast.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, do you want to give some of the facts about Dire Straits? I mean, like you said, what an amazing debut album. Not every artist gets to have some of these facts. I can read them off, or you can, either one, because I'm looking at some of the notes you prepared here, and this is pretty amazing for Dire Straits on their debut album.
I guess what I found as a common connector between these two records, besides the fact that we got them advanced together, you know, and those are the only two in the box. But these are two records that I would challenge anybody to put on at any point in time. And they're great to either actively listen to or have in the background. Because when you listen to Dire Straits, it's Six Blade Knife or Southbound Again. Obviously, Sultan's a Swing was the big hit there.
Mm-hmm.
But Wild West End is such a great song.
Yeah,
I mean, there's just some of these songs that clearly are like timeless. And then when you go over to Ricky Lee Jones and I love Last Chance Texaco. I just think that's the coolest song.
Yeah.
And I remember my ex-wife and I were naming a hair salon for her, and it was on 6th and Lamar, really like the epicenter of Austin. And I was going through album collections to get, you know, some creativity sparked as to what could we call this hair salon.
Right.
So in my short list was Coolsville, you know, from Ricky Lee Jones.
Yes.
But we ended up picking Avalon, which was Avalon Hair Salon, and then we used the Roxy Music Avalon as her hold button.
Wow, I never knew that story.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool story, man.
Yeah.
You know, another thing about Dire Straits is they moved into some of their other albums, like Making Movies. I mean, you know, that was such a great song I played at my campus radio station. And then, of course, it all blew up, man, when Brothers in Arms came out. And that was a game changer because that album was, it won every Grammy you could think of. I mean, so many awards. So Dire Straits has done well, and Mark Knopfler is still out there touring solo. So, I mean, to this day, he's still doing quite well. He's just an amazing guitar player.
No, you're absolutely right. And the thing is when you look at Brothers in Arms, it topped 30 million.
Wow.
So earlier in this podcast, we mentioned the top three. It'd be kind of interesting to see where Brothers in Arms at maybe number 5 or number 6.
I got to think it's at least top 10.
I think so too. I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah.
And that album in particular was the first album to ever sell a million copies on compact disc.
Yes.
When compact disc first came out.
I think I may have told this story before.
You
I can't
did.
Remember about I was working at Camelot Music and this could be one of the attributes that got it there to a million sellers, because we were starting to get rid of vinyl in Camelot, and supposedly the story I'd heard is that Camelot did a deal with all the record labels, like, look, we'll put your stuff on the shelves, but you got to get it to us first before any of our competitors. And Dire Straits, I remember this so eloquently, the way that he was like, this is a CD player, this is what a CD looks like. When anyone comes in and says, hey, I want to hear the difference in vinyl and CD, you always put on Brothers in Arms. That was the go-to album to play.
Yeah, you had mentioned that, and that's such a logical choice, because kind of like if you were to listen to Steely Dan.
Yeah.
Steely Dan has that depth and the jazz, and it's crisp, and it's really, well, I think Dire Straits has that type of depth and that type of texture. Texture is probably a really good word to use.
Yeah.
So I could see where that would be a perfect demo, especially if you're even if you're demonstrating like speakers any kind of hardware.
Right.
So Dire Straits went on to sell over 100 million records in their career. And again, this is being recorded in October 2019 in Austin. And I had a chance to see Mark Knopfler, I think about 6 weeks ago.
Right.
And it was a great show. I mean, he had a phenomenal band. He's older. He moved a lot slower, but he was very fluid in his playing. And, of course, his voice is so distinctive. But his band that he had brought with him, kind of like Alice Cooper, they don't fool around. They bring the best of the best.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes the show pretty enjoyable.
Dire Straits is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well, but Mark did not show up for the award ceremony. He bypassed it. Some of his other guys were showing up, but Mark did not make that trek to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You're right. And I have to tell you, there's a show on Sunday morning called, I think it's called Sunday Morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an hour and a half, and it's a lifestyle show. And they interviewed him. And he said, I have to tell you, the fame component about this was never my cup of tea.
Right.
And they had shown him like driving a very nondescript, mellow motorcycle to this warehouse somewhere in London. And the door opened and he drove his little motorcycle in. And it wasn't like a very hip motorcycle. It was a very like abnormal, mellow, nondescript motorcycle.
Right.
And he parks it. And then all of a sudden you see this massive recording studio with all the gear and all the equipment. And that's where he loves to be and where he still loves to perform and play and write music. But he's very much anti-fame, anti-social.
Right.
And that's his prerogative.
Yeah, and I get that. And I will say this, that I interviewed Gavin Rossdale of the band Bush. Believe it or not, Bush is now eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they released their album in 1995. Just so you know what you have to do, you have to release your first commercial recording at least 25 years ago to be considered. So I was kind of joking with Gavin because I was trying to make him feel old because, you know,
right.
He's such a handsome man. He was married to Gwen Stefani, such a stud. And I was like, what do you think about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And he was like a lot of other folks from the UK or London or whatever, he said, it's just not that big of a thing because we didn't grow up with it. We didn't grow up knowing what Cleveland meant or Detroit meant, a lot of things. He's like, so for us, when we get immersed into this American Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he goes like, it just doesn't have that importance to us, say, as it would an American-bred band. So, and that made a lot of sense to me.
It does make sense. Yeah, you were hanging with him like just a few weeks ago, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did. Yes. Yeah. He's a great guy.
I've heard he's a really
very,
good
much
guy.
Of a gentleman. So.
Yeah, I heard that. Well, I think we've kind of hit our limit of what our listeners are going to put up with from us.
We could talk all day, but we won't. We'll bring you a new episode next week.
Can I tease them a little bit, though?
Yeah.
So Talking Heads confirmed that they're going to do an interview.
Wow.
Yep.
That is exciting.
And I've got a line in to David Lee Roth so he can tell us about his Las Vegas residency.
This is cool.
And I got a couple other things up my sleeve.
Wow, Fred, you have been working hard. This man has been pounding the pavement. He's getting guests set up, and all I get to do is just sit here and ask you questions. I don't do anything.
No, that's not true. But thank you guys for listening. And, of course, because this is grassroots, we really need the power of you guys to get behind this thing and share it. When you share it on Facebook, it goes to your whole database. So share, rate.
Give us those reviews and 5 stars. We love it because it only helps us get a little bit higher to the top of the list when people go searching for the podcast. It makes it so much easier for you guys to find us.
Yep. And on the website, you can email me. So if you guys have questions or you want us to answer some things for you or anything, just don't hesitate.
I think it's kind of cool that you can only say you can email me because I think people decipher our voices now. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, that would be.
That was Fred, by the way, who said you can email me.
Well, so, you know what?
This now is audio, Fred.
Now I'm going to
can't see us.
Now I'm going to go put your email on there. Let you get all of them.
Promotion Man: the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.